Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball back with me this week after taking a week off to go to the happiest place on earth. So, Pete, how was Disney, and glad to have you back.
It's good to be back. Disney was fun. I was still able to get my fab in for TGFBI, where I am just routinely getting my ass kicked every single day. Every time I'm like, oh man, I probably had a good day today, and then I go and check and nope, still very bad. So I was able to get my fab in, which I was happy about, but otherwise it was a great trip.
So as we're recording this on Sunday, you and I are finishing off our head-to-head matchup in the Keeper Cut Listener Head-to-Head League. And I'm wondering, I'm up pretty big right now. And do I need to just like temper my excitement and realize that you've been gone for a week and maybe not fully attentive to that?
No, nothing like that. I mean, I'm in so many daily leagues. I set them for the week, but I don't think any starts were missed or anything like that. It's just going to be a full throttle win. I'm looking at my pitching and I see, like, I know Grayson Rodriguez had a tough go of it. I think Pablo did as well. So not too surprised. I'm still waiting for like a lot of first homers in that league. Like Spencer Torkelson hasn't homered. Gleyber Torres hasn't homered. Ke'Bryan Hayes apparently has. That must have been very recently. And obviously Acuña's off to a
Yesterday?
Yeah, it must have been. It must have been. And Acuña's off to a super slow start. So my record says one thing, but I'm not that impressed with my team so far.
Yeah. It's you have some guys though that should be turning it around, which is perhaps a nice segue into our topic. So let me introduce the topic real quick, and then we'll go back and talk jersey numbers. But the topic we're going to talk about today is slow starters. So last week, I had Raymond Atherton on while Pete was away. 2 weeks ago, Pete and I were sort of fed up with everybody just complaining about pitcher injuries and everything. And we talked about guys who are off to great starts and, you know, are those sustainable, or who are we buying? Who are we maybe just going to sell high? We're going to look at the other end of the spectrum today, and these are guys who have been struggling. We're going to try to keep up the good vibes. We'll try to find some guys in here. We think, hey, like, stick with this guy. He's going to turn around, but it might not be all that. We'll have to see. We're going to go through some names of guys who are just really not where we want them to be. But before we get to that, it is episode 134 of the Keeper Cup podcast. And so we're going to look at jersey number 34. I suspect you've got a guy in mind for 34.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there's only one answer for today's episode, and that is, of course, David Ortiz. I'm pulling up the other options right now, and I don't even care if Babe Ruth is there.
Oh, there's some other options.
Yeah, Nolan Ryan's pretty good, but it's David Ortiz.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Ryan's pretty good. I think the other name that stands out for me, I mean, if you look at this, again, we always have to like sort this, and you're like, oh, the best player to ever wear the number 34 is Randy Johnson, except he wore it for 1 year, and it's not really a number anyone associates with him, so he doesn't count. But if you focus on guys that are associated with a number, Ryan is pretty clearly first in terms of sort of best ever. Doesn't mean he gets the episode. Ortiz is second, but Ortiz is very close to like Kirby Puckett, Felix Hernandez. Those are really the next two, and then you get down to like Bryce Harper wore it with the Nationals, but not with the Phillies. So he could be on his way to taking over this number, but he gave up the number, so maybe not. I got a little soft spot for Felix. When I moved to Seattle, the Mariners were not particularly good, but I got my Mariners tickets right away when I moved here, and Felix was in his prime at the time. And so I do have a soft spot for him, but I won't take David Ortiz away from you. I think he's earned it. So Big Poppy, this episode's for you. Let's get back to our purpose of being here. And so I'm going to start off with the pitchers. And I'm going to explain what I did to create this list before reading the list. So I took projected FIP from Fangraph's depth charts projections. For those not familiar with depth charts, it combines Zips and Steamer. So two good systems. Depth charts is one of the systems I look at for pitching. What I did is I took all pitchers who had a projection and had thrown at least 10 innings so far this year, and then I compared their projected FIP to their actual FIP. I did this yesterday morning. So today is Sunday that we're recording. You're going to hear this Monday. So Saturday the 27th in the morning is when I did this. So it is possible some of these guys like threw a great start or a great inning yesterday. I don't think so. And that's changed the story here. I don't think anyone really flipped the script yesterday. It's also possible somebody did the opposite, right? There could be somebody who's missing from this list who got like lit up yesterday, and it's like, whoa, why are you guys not talking about him? But that's why. But let me read these names, then Pete, we can start talking about some of these guys. So let's start with this. Oh, the thing I did is I compared their FIPs, their actual FIP to their projected FIP. But what I did is I took anybody whose projected FIP was less than or equal to 4.25. So not necessarily great, but anybody who had a projected FIP that was like, hey, this guy's a decent pitcher and probably worth some fantasy consideration. But as an actual FIP of over 5.25, which is, you know, not good. So that was sort of the range I was looking at. I came up with a total of, let's see, 16 pitchers. Now, I'm going to start off by reading four of them who I don't think are really worth discussing. Hobie Milner, Scott McGough, Alex Fiedo, and Ronzi Contreras. Not that these guys have never been fantasy interesting, but like, I don't know. Does anybody care about those guys in detail in terms of like why they're off to a slow fantasy start in a keeper league? Like, I don't think so. So here are the names that may matter to you. There's three relievers on this list. The three relievers are Brian Abreu, Adbert Alzolay, and Tanner Scott. All of those guys were pretty well rostered in fantasy, and none of them are off to a good start. And then the starting pitchers are Louis Varland, DL Hall, Joe Musgrove, Kenta Maeda, AJ Puck, Michael King, Hunter Brown, Tristan McKenzie, and Chris Bassett. And that is just, like, to me, it's a super fascinating list because you've got guys on there like Musgrove and Bassett who are pretty established, Maeda as well, pretty established guys, and like we sort of thought we knew what to expect and we haven't been getting it. You've got guys like Hall, Varland, and Puck, and Brown, and King, who are all like, they were hot topics in the offseason. People were like, I had AJ Puck in all sorts of teams. I have AJ Puck in very few teams now. So Pete, do you want to pick a name from this list to talk about first? Anyone on there that you're particularly interested in, concerned about?
So my biggest concern on this list, I think, is Hunter Brown. I think all conversations need to start there. There's some veteran names here that I'm not as concerned with. Kenta Maeda, I didn't have a lot of hope for going into the season. Joe Musgrove, I guess, is probably worth talking about considering how high he was getting drafted. But a guy like Chris Bassett, someone who should age fine, I'm not terribly concerned with just yet. Not a guy that really relies on velocity or anything like that. But Hunter Brown, that's the type of player I have serious concerns about. He was not an elite prospect. I wouldn't put him in the class of like Yuri Perez or Grayson Rodriguez or those names that were getting drafted really in the top 100 towards the end of draft season. And that showed in ADP. Most people weren't valuing that way. Obviously, I think he was around ADP 180. If I had to guess, I'd have to look that up. But that clearly, even right now, was way too high. I think we can already say that, even though it's only the end of April, there's been rumors about him maybe getting options sent back down to figure things out because he's been kind of brutal.
Kind of brutal. That's kind.
it's kind. And I mean, look at his second half last season. I don't know why people are all that surprised. If you look at his ERA in the second half last year, that was around 6.5. His whip in the second half, his whip in the first half wasn't very good, but his whip in the second half was 1.41. So, I mean, I don't know, Chad, if you remember, but when he first got the call, folks were like, man, he's really like Verlander, and he's learning from Verlander, and his mechanics are just like Verlander. And it's like, okay. But he's not Justin Verlander, and I think this guy got a little bit too hyped too quickly. You factor in the troubles that the Astros as a team are having this year, so the win potential hasn't even been there for Hunter Brown. It's a full disaster, and I do not expect him to meet his projected FIP rest of season.
Yeah, there's also some weird stuff here where, like, last year in the second half, the strikeouts went way down, and, like, he lost basically a strikeout per nine. His strikeout rate went down from 28.1% to 24.8%, but his walk rate went down from 8.4 to 8.1. And so that's bad overall. Like, that's too many strikeouts to trade for walks, but it was a little bit on the balanced side where you can be like, okay, at least at least he's controlling the walks a little bit. Maybe that's a sign of something. This year, the walk rate is up to 12.9%, and the strikeout rate has just plummeted to 8.3%. Or 18.3, not 8.3. Even 18.3 is not good, but 8.3 would be real bad. But gotten really ugly, and he's got some real challenges with home runs. He had a 21% home run per fly ball rate last year. It was somewhat tempting to look at that and be like, there's no way that's going to continue. It's 21.4% this year. It's basically the same. And so even though he throws a gets a decent chunk of ground balls, it's not really going to help if you give up that many home runs, especially when you're walking that many guys. Like if you put guys on base and give up home runs, which is what Hunter Brown is doing, bad things are going to happen. And so even when even if you think he's going to pitch to his actual sort of underlying stats, right? The ERA is 9.68 for Hunter Brown. His FIP is 5.48. His XFIP is 4.38. His Sierra is 4.75. Like even if you think he's going to pitch not to the ERA, but to the numbers he's put up underneath that, it hasn't been good. And I think the thing, he's a perfect person to start with for our show, because in redraft, he's a cut and he's an easy cut because he may put it together. He may not put it together, but like I don't know. If I had him in redraft, he's gone. It's an easy decision. Even if he puts it together for the second half, I'm just not going to regret that if I avoid him for the rest of the first half. And he's unusable right now. The bigger question for me is in keepers, and especially deep keepers. Right? If you're in a league where you keep three, he's not going to be one of your three. There's almost nothing he could do this year to become one of your three, especially at the draft cost you likely paid for him. I had him in a dynasty where I was, keeping 45 or something like that. Or if you're in an auto new league where you keep as many as you want and you've got him cheap, are you like, let's wait and see if he figures this out? I don't want to cut bait in a guy who could be part of my rotation for the next 5 years. Because like in this dynasty league where I had him, part of this is I have other guys. I have Brian Abreu who's on this list. I have Joe Musgrove who's on this list. I have a bunch of injured guys, and we don't have super deep benches necessarily in this league. I cut bait. I cut him in a dynasty league. He got picked up immediately by another team. There is a chance that, 2-3 years from now, they're like, man, I can't believe Chad cut this guy. Thank God I've got him in my roster. But like, I want to win now. And I had this guy in my roster who I literally couldn't use. And so I was like, forget it. I need to replace him. Is that an overreaction?
No, not at all. This is not a guy who is in the prospect class of those other names where like I would think that's an overreaction. Yeah. He was not in that upper crust of pitching prospects, and the swinging strike rate is down at 8.9%. Like he needs to give us a sign. Now his last outing, 4 innings pitched, 6 strikeouts. It was still not great. He still walked a pair. Yeah, 2 walks, 4 hits, 3 earned in just 4 innings. So it wasn't a good outing. It was against a bad offense in the Nationals, but at least he gave us maybe something with the strikeouts there. So if you weren't desperate for cap space or for a bench spot and you were like, I want to give this guy another chance through the rotation, I get that too. I don't think you should just cut him just for the sake of cutting him. But if you need the space, you need the money, then he's not doing anything for you right now.
Yeah. So let's jump to another pitcher. And this is a guy who... he concerns me on a couple of fronts. One is I do have him in some fantasy leagues. He's also been cut in some leagues where I can pick him up. The other is that my Guardians are off to a super tremendous start this year, and yet they've lost Shane Bieber, and Tanner Bibee hadn't been particularly great until yesterday. He was brilliant yesterday against Atlanta. But Tristan McKenzie is on this list. And if the Guardians are going to do anything like maintain the start that they're off to, he needs to be better than he's been. And so he is a guy that I am watching closely. Now, unlike Hunter Brown, there's a couple of things that are different about McKenzie and Brown. One is McKenzie's done it, right? He's put together like very, very good full seasons in the past. The other is he is starting to at least show maybe a little something. His last 2 starts combined against Boston and Oakland. It's easy to be like, Boston doesn't have any of their hitters and Oakland is terrible. But like Oakland's been playing pretty decently and Boston's been hitting lately. So they're not, I don't think these are either of those are great offenses, but I don't think they're as bad as people might want to think they are. But against those two teams, he's gone 9 innings, 13 strikeouts, and a 3.38 FIP, 3.00 ERA. Now, it isn't all sunshine and rainbows. He still walked 5 guys across those 2 starts. He really, really needs to rein that in. On the season, he has 18 strikeouts and 22 innings, which is not great, but like you can live with that from a starting pitcher. He's also got 17 walks, 18 strikeouts, 17 walks. Tristan McKenzie, that's not going to do it. You can also look at his velocity. It has been down on the year for sure. But it has somewhat trended up over the last couple starts, just a small amount. I mean, depends how you look at it. So his first and third starts in the year, his fastball was sitting at its lowest. It popped up a little bit in the second. In the fourth, it was back up. And then in his most recent start, his fifth start, it was the highest it had been all year. So that's possibly a good sign. It also was the tightest range on his fastball velocity he's seen all year. So early in the season, he was, you know, like he would occasionally hit 94 and occasionally throw 87. Like he was all over the place, especially in his third start. This time he's starting to rein it in a little bit more. So maybe there's some good signs there. Then there's also the report about Tristan McKenzie's elbow. And this is, I want to make sure I say this correctly because I don't want to misstate what's going on here. But he injured his elbow. He had an elbow injury a year ago. It was last June, and this is an article in The Athletic from Zach Mizell and Jason Lloyd. Mizell is one of my favorite Cleveland baseball writers, so you know, guy, I really value what he finds and says. Says, last June, he faced the most significant decision of his career. McKenzie had to basically figure out if he wanted to have Tommy John surgery last June. He decided not to, and to go a rehab route. And it depends how, I mean, he says he feels no pain. His velocity is starting to come back, but you are running into a situation now where like he has a non-surgically repaired elbow issue. There's a tear. It's not a complete tear. He's obviously able to pitch through it. He is on the mound. He says he's not having pain. There's no evidence that he is hurt except for the performance. And so when you look at McKenzie, do you see like, okay, things are starting to trend back the right direction. He missed a bunch of time last year. It's totally understandable that he's off to a slow start. Or are you like, you know, he didn't get surgery before. It's just a matter of time. I want out while I can get out.
Yeah, there's just so few players that have kind of gone through something similar and avoided surgery. Masahiro Tanaka comes to mind recently. Zach Gallen comes to mind. But it's just, that's such a scary one for me. I think in Dynasty, I'm looking to move in Keeper. In Keeper and Redraft, though, I think I'm going to hold on. He's pitched all of his games so far at Cleveland except for one in Seattle, and I don't think those two places are known for their beautiful April weather. So I think that would help explain the velocity a little bit. And, Luis Castillo goes through this every year, right? He's one that comes to mind. I think CeCe Sabathia used to go through it, like these rough starts. David Price, for sure, were weather-related and really related to velocity and just getting up to speed. So a guy with as thin of a frame as McKenzie, I could see the cold getting to him a little bit. And, maybe that explains the velocity. I've always loved the pitcher. Wow. The walks are weird. 6 of them came against the Yankees, and the Yankees are just a wagon, and they're an on-base wagon. So, you know, do you begin to maybe consider writing that off a little bit? I don't know. It's hard to. You can't just remove a start when he's only had 5. So in redraft and in keeper, sure, I'll hold on a little bit longer. After the last 2 starts, like you said, it's hard to just completely move on, especially since this was a guy you probably used a top 200 pick on. But in Dynasty, the elbow worries me too much. If I could get something of similar value, which would be maybe a little tricky to do given his numbers so far, I think I would be comfortable moving on.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at his overall numbers, you mentioned that Yankees start. He pitched the opening weekend against Seattle. McKenzie in that start was pretty bad. 3 1/3 innings, 2 walks, 2 strikeouts, 5 runs, 4 of them earned. He also gave up a home run in that one. And then he had a pretty decent result against the White Sox. Now, we know sort of in retrospect that the White Sox team he was facing is not good. But 5 2/3 shutout innings, but he walked 4 and struck out 2. Then he had that start against the Yankees, 6 runs, 5 of them earned in 4 innings, 6 walks and 1 strikeout. It was a weird start, and then those two against Boston and Oakland. Now his next start should come up Wednesday at Houston, and then it's unclear to me if he's going to get the Angels next. I don't think he's going to get the Angels next. I think he's going to get whoever the Guardians face after the Angels, which is Detroit. So, you know, Houston, I feel like I've heard all this talk about how, like, oh, Houston's so bad. And, like, we, you know, someone the other day said something about how, like, they benched a starting pitcher against Houston. And, like, I can't remember who it was. They benched someone against Houston who had a good start. And they were like, I still can't get over the idea that Houston is this great offense. And, like, they're clearly not anymore. But, like, Houston is still a very good offense. They have no pitch.
Yeah.
Right. And like their record is not a reflection of how they're hitting the ball. They are still one of the better offenses in baseball. So that's a real tough start before he gets probably Detroit and then probably the White Sox again. So it's going to be an interesting stretch for Tristan McKenzie, because I think, you know, what I'll be looking for at Houston is not necessarily like a brilliant start, but like, does he control the walks? Is the velocity starting to tick up? Maybe the warmer weather helps him, to your point. But then those next two starts, Detroit and Chicago, become like, all right, you gotta lock it in against those teams. You can't let those teams get to you.
Yeah.
And so I'm with you on McKenzie. I'm not ready to give up on him. I do think in Dynasty and perhaps in some keeper leagues, I am at a point where the combination of the performance and the elbow concerns are enough that if I thought I could get a good trade for him, I probably would take it. The thing is, I just don't think that McKenzie has the trade value you want right now versus the upside of if the velocity comes back a little bit more and he reins in the walks, you've got a guy who can be just a truly great pitcher on your hands. And so I'm probably just holding Tristan McKenzie. I don't think I have a lot of other choices. So anyone else on this list, starters or relievers, that you want to talk about?
The relievers, not so much. I was, you know, not really big on Tanner Scott after that spring training performance. Anyway, Brian Abreu off to a weird start. How much of that was because he suspended the first couple games and then was like thrust into a team that was already like dysfunctioning? They were falling apart against the Yankees every night. I don't know how much that plays into it because it's such a small sample with relievers. But I don't know, man. Michael King, that's a weird one. Because just when it looked like, you know, he was maybe figuring everything out, he had that brilliant start. I can't remember who it was against. I'm pulling it up right now. He had a brilliant outing recently, like elite, like what we were hoping we were getting.
Yeah, at Milwaukee. So he had his first 4 starts of the year. He's gone sort of hot and cold, right? He started off the year against the Dodgers. I don't know what you take from a guy giving up 3 runs on 4 hits and 3 walks with 5 strikeouts and 3 1/3 at the Dodgers
on March 21st.
Oh yeah, it wasn't even at the Dodgers. It was in
South Seoul. Korea. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, I'm not real concerned about that. Then he had sort of a very strange start against the Giants where he struck out 6 in 4 innings but walked 7, which is just insane. But he only gave up 2 runs over 4 innings. Then he had a really good start against the Giants. 7 innings, no runs and 4 hits, only 1 walk, but only 4 strikeouts. Then the Dodgers got to him because the Dodgers get to people. Then he had a brilliant start. This is the one you were talking about at Milwaukee. Michael King at Milwaukee, 7 2/3, 10 strikeouts, 2 walks, a run on 2 hits. Just lights out. Then he had another bad start, 5 strikeouts, 3 walks, and 3 2/3, 4 earned runs, 6 total runs, and 8 hits. But that was at Colorado. So, you know, you mentioned with Tristan McKenzie the ability to be like, oh, you can't just write off one start because it was against the Yankees, but like, you had a start against the Yankees that went really poorly. Well, his bad starts, he's been alternating good starts and bad starts. And other than the one against the Giants on what was effectively his first start of the real season, he's got the bad start against the Dodgers in Seoul, the bad start against the Dodgers at Dodger Stadium, and a bad start against the Rockies in Colorado. And it's so now, then you've got his first start of the, like I said, the real season, the non-Soul season was ugly against the Giants. So now I'm now excusing. He's made, and actually the one in Seoul, he didn't start. He came in relief. He threw three in the third innings, but still. But he's made five starts, six appearances, and I am now excusing four of those six, which
he's actually like an ace.
Ridiculous thing to do. But I kind of think it's true because, like, okay, so you don't start him at Coors and you don't start him against the Dodgers. If you didn't start him at Coors and you didn't start him against the Dodgers, you've been pretty happy with the results so far.
Yeah.
Right? You'd be annoyed about that one start against San Francisco, but even that, like, it depends what your format is, right? In Otto New, that was really ugly because seven walks and a home run in four innings, like, that'll mess you up in an Otto New points league. If you were in a 5x5 league, the whip is ugly, but the ERA is two earned runs over four innings. It's not great, but, like, he's not killing you with that. And he struck out six. So, like, that, and that was his bad start, not counting the starts I'm not counting. But that's sort of my read on Michael King, though, a little bit, is like, I kind of think I wouldn't have used him three of the six times he's been out there. And so the fact that those weren't good, I don't care. And, you know, it's one thing if I was saying, like, oh, I wouldn't have used Michael King in three of those starts, and they were like three random decent offenses, like, then you worry about, like, well, when do you use him? Like, if you don't use him against any good offense, when can you use him? But I'm just saying the Dodgers and at Coors, right? And I don't think there's a whole lot of pitch, like, how many pitchers are you starting at Coors? How many pitchers are you starting against the Dodgers? There aren't that many. I mean, I get in a head-to-head league or in a league where you have, like, you know, an innings pitched as a category. Like, there are leagues where you just, if guys are on your roster, you start them and you live with the consequences. And I get that. But, like, in my Otto New leagues where I can be a little, I can pick and choose because there's an inning pitch cap. Like, there are very few pitchers I'm starting against those in those circumstances. I'm starting everybody against the Rockies, but not necessarily at Coors. So, yeah, I'm sort of not worried about Michael King. Now I want to go look if I should be buying low.
Well, two things about King. One, I have no answers to. The other is maybe you want to sell him for a completely unrelated reason to performance. And the first thing is his pitch mix is, like, flipped on its head this year. So he was great when he started for the Yankees last year. That's why they were able to get Juan Soto for him, because he was awesome.
Right.
And his pitch mix is kind of weird now. He's basically flipped it. He's using his four-seamer and his changeup way more and his sinker and sweeper a little bit less. That's just a very surface-level view of this. Maybe that was actually pretty much in line with when he was starting last year, and what I'm really looking at is the majority of his pitches from relief. I don't know. Now, and I also know he's a tough player to move in certain formats because he is starting pitcher, relief pitcher eligible. So in your weekly leagues that have RP and SP slots, he's maybe a little bit more valuable, especially in those points formats. But this is a guy who's 29. He's dealt with injuries in the past, or he's turning 29. He's 29 or he's turning 29. In the most innings pitched he's ever thrown in a season is 104. Now, the Padres definitely traded Juan Soto with the idea of being, we're going to get more than 104 innings out of this guy. But how much more? I don't know. So if Chad is right and Michael King begins to normalize, and it's been a bit of a schedule thing, if he rattles off a couple of really good starts, that's when I'd start to consider moving him and selling high. Because I maybe not in Roto, but in head-to-head, I don't know if this guy's going to be there for your playoffs. I really don't. And we're wrong about this kind of stuff all the time. Teams are very aware of how to, you know, manage a player's innings, when to, you know, maybe turn them into a reliever for a little bit, or phantom IL stint for a little bit, or whatever it might be. But I don't know what a realistic expectation is for Michael King innings pitched from here. And that has me concerned a little bit, even aside from the up and down performances.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And I think on the pitch mix front, yes, it is flipped, right? Last year, his sinker was basically his least used pitch. There's also Savant has him throwing a handful of sliders, but
it's probably might be
just miscategorized sweepers.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's ignore that. His sinker was his least used pitch. This year it's his most used pitch. Last year, sweeper was second least. This year, sweeper second most. Like, however, if you look at the percentages of use on those pitches, last year, those four pitches, four seamer, change, sweeper, sinker, ranged from 20.4% for the sinker to 29% for the four-seamer for Michael King. So basically a 9% range across those pitches. This year, the changeup is way down. He's only using that 14.5% of the time, but the others are between 22.7 and 33.5. So, yes, it's a different order, but he used those pitches fairly evenly last year, and he's still using them fairly evenly this year. You know, he may, like, I'd be curious to look sort of start by start. So his most recent start, which was the one at Coors, he used his changeup and four-seamer a ton more than especially his, especially his slider and sweeper. That makes sense, right? That's like kind of a thing you expect a pitcher to do at Coors. So like, I don't know. I sort of look at this and like, he had one start, he had one appearance in Seoul, which who knows what to make of that. He had one start at Coors where like his pitch mix is going to be messed up because you can't throw pitches the same way there. I'm sort of like, whatever. I'm not worried about the pitch mix.
Yeah, I didn't bring it up as something to be concerned about necessarily. I mean, something that, you know, Nick says all the time is throw your best pitch more. That changeup, you mentioned it was at 14.5% last year, but that was generating a 41% whiff rate. The whiff rate was great on that last year, and so he's increased the usage of it by 10%. The whiff rate has actually even got better. So, like, if anything, maybe that's a good change. It's just interesting that he's not necessarily the exact same pitcher. But you're right. It's unique circumstances.
Yeah, so let's take a quick break, and we come back. We'll turn our attention to the hitters. Maybe we'll come back to some of these pitchers later, but let's turn our attention to the hitters after this. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball here. We're talking about slow starts and whether we think they're going to turn around or not. We've been talking about pitchers so far. Let's bring up the hitter list so that we can at least discuss some of those guys as well. We can always go back to the pitchers later. But I did something similar here. I used a different projection system. I used the BatX. It's the system I like best for hitter projections. But it did a similar thing. I took a look at projected WOBA, an actual WOBA. I only took players who had both a projection before the season and at least 20 plate appearances so far this year. And I took anybody who was projected for WOBA over 320. Now, again, 320 is sort of like my 4.25 FIP for pitchers. Like 320 is not like, oh, this guy was destined to be a star, but it is a guy that you were like, this guy was useful. There was probably some upside there. I might be interested. And I think the list bears that out. But it's projected WOBA over 320, actual WOBA under 250. So this is guys who are like, they have been unusable, even though you thought they'd at least be interesting. And some of these guys you thought would be way more than interesting. So here's the list of the 10 hitters, 11 hitters, with the biggest gaps between their actual WOBA and their projected WOBA so far. Nolan Jones, Randy Arozarena, Austin Slater, Nick Castellanos, Andrew Vaughn, Max Kepler, Christian Encarnacion Strand, Alejandro Kirk, Gleyber Torres, Jordan Walker, and Rowdy Tellez. Now, sort of like the pitchers, there's some names in here like Tellez, Slater. Like Slater's really interesting in really deep leagues where you could use him as a purely a platoon back because he's the small side of a platoon. Tellez, I don't think a lot of people are super excited about. Alejandro Kirk, like there were so many interesting catchers this year that Kirk's value has really fallen. It's like there's a handful of guys on this list that like aren't that interesting, but then you've got, you know, Nolan Jones broke out big time last year. Randy Arozarena is an established star. Max Kepler had a great year last year. I was really high on Max Kepler. Jordan Walker just got optioned, and you know he's the future supposedly, right? So like, there's a bunch of guys on this list that are interesting in some way or another. Pete, any name on there that jumps out at you that you're like, yeah, we got to talk about this guy?
So the top two guys, actually, I wanted to talk about both. I want to start with Randy, though, because I think that one's pretty easy. Randy Arozarena is a notorious kind of slow starter. Career OPS in April of 698, career WRC plus in April of exactly 100. He's a guy who career WOBA in April of 306. So yeah, he's underperforming that, but he's a guy who's like always hard to read. He underperforms his expected statistics quite often, or overperforms his expected statistics quite often. Just kind of a weird player that is hard to read. And so I have concerns about the Rays lineup, but I have for years, and he just continues to hit. So he's one that I wouldn't mind buying low on, which is brand new for me. I'm usually the low guy on Randy Arozarena, but seeing this, I'm thinking like, I'm not worried about Randy. Nolan Jones, though, this is a guy who I, going into the season, I kind of viewed him as like, I obviously see the upside. I mean, look, he went 20-20 in 106 games. That's awesome. And he's in cores. So like, I get that. But I think a lot of folks, especially because of his ADP, didn't look at the potential downside. And when you look at Nolan Jones, like even last year, you could say, oh, he hits so well against lefties. Sure, the batting average suggests that, but that came with a 29% strikeout rate. I mean, this guy strikes out all the time. Then factor in the BABIP is up around 400. Like, sure, he did well in the minor leagues with high BABIPs and with high strikeout rates, but I think it was too much like, okay, I'm not worried about the BABIP. I'm not worried about the strikeout rate because he's a power speed guy in cores and it's just going to work out. And I'm not saying he can't end up being a good player, but I think we're clearly seeing the downside that really wasn't accounted for in his exorbitant ADP that was maybe driven a little bit by the lack of depth in outfield, certainly a concern about speed at that point in the draft. But man, this was a dude who I stayed away from. I'm in like 17 leagues, I think it is. I have him nowhere. And so it's a little bit of confirmation bias, I'll admit that. But at this moment in time, I'm very relieved I stayed away from the Nolan Jones train. And he's actually being, he's been dropped in a few of my 12 teamers, which is aggressive.
Yeah. So two different guys to talk about here. Let me start with Jones. We go back to Randy. But with Jones, when I agree with everything you're saying about last year. I think, you know, the strikeout rate and walk rate, like he's a patient hitter. And with the power that he has and the ability to get on base that he has, like I'll live with that strikeout rate. So I wasn't super concerned about that. It's gone up this year. That's not great. And it's gone up, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about why or how it's gone up because I think it's going to come back down. But yeah, the BABIP, like I do believe he is a high BABIP hitter. And if you look at the projections for him, right? Like you, if you go pull up his, you know, you look at his Zips projection, Zips projected a 350 BABIP, Steamer 337, the Bat Axe 339, ATC 352. Like there is like the projection, the computers think that he is a high BABIP hitter. I think he's a high BABIP hitter. 401, which is what we did last year. It's like crazy. Nolan Jones is not going to have a 401 BABIP every year. So I, you know, it's interesting. I stayed away from him at draft cost. I have him in leagues where I had him from last year where he was cheap and I held him. And I'm still holding him there because I don't think what we're seeing right now is the real him. He's got some injury stuff going on with the back, which always can be an issue. Now, that strikeout rate for Nolan Jones was 29.7% last year, just 35.6% this year. Strikeouts have always been an issue for him, so I don't expect that he's going to have a low strikeout rate. But his chase rate is down. His contact rate on pitches in the zone is up. His swinging strike rate is way down. It was 12.1% last year. It's 9.9% this year. He is getting fewer pitches in the zone this year. It was 43%. It's down to 40%, which makes sense, right? Pitchers are over time, presumably learning to challenge him less. However, his first strike rate, right? The percentage of at-bats that start with a first pitch strike is up from 57.5% to 62.4%. I think that's kind of noise. And I don't think the strikeout rate, like I actually see a lot of positive in his underlying plate discipline, right? He's chasing less, he's making more contact in the zone. Like those are good things. Those are things you want to see. So I think the strikeout rate will be fine. I think the BABIP, which is currently 255, is going to come up. He's not going to have a 5.6% home run per fly ball rate all year. That's just not going to happen. His hard hit rate is fine versus last year. His exit velocity is down a little bit, but not a ton. I'm seeing enough underlying stuff with Jones that I'm just sort of like, I think he'll be fine. But I do think we need to be aware that fine for Nolan Jones is not going to be, he just will do 2023 again, and he'll get 150 games instead of 100. Like that's not where this is headed with him. But to your point, like, that should have been how people were viewing him in January, right? Like that, this isn't new. And so for me, I don't think a lot has changed with how I'm viewing Nolan Jones. Yes, we are seeing, you know, we're seeing how bad the floor can be, and that, you know, that causes some nerves. Like, I'm not going to lie. I'm tracking what's happening with Nolan Jones, and I'm a little worried, but I'm not jumping ship. I'm not cutting. I'm not selling low. I would trade him, but I'm not selling low, because I think he's going to bounce back and be fine. And at some point, he'll go through a stretch of games at Coors where he just goes off, and that'll be that. And like, he'll either be back, or you can at least sell him at full value if that's, you know, that's what you need to do.
Yeah.
Talking about a Rosarena.
Real quick on Jones.
Oh, go on.
To your point, and I think it's important for our folks, our listeners, to understand that, is like, if you're in a position like Chad, where you maybe picked him up for like $1 or $2 last year, and you now have him for $4 or $5, maybe you got hit real hard in arbitration, you have him for $8, I'm not cutting that player. But I just wanted to like reaffirm Chad's point there that like, if you took this dude in a draft ahead of Mike Trout, I'm sorry, that's on you. Like, that was a poor decision. And no matter what happens the rest of the season, I'm going to continue to tell you that was a poor decision. That doesn't mean that you double down on your poor decision and cut him just because he's performing poorly. Any guy with a strikeout rate that hovers around 30% is going to go through horrendous, horrendous slumps. And so if you believed he was potentially a top 50 player going into the season, despite that strikeout rate, then you should have accepted that he will go through slumps like this. So don't be thrown off that the slump just happened to happen in the first month of the season.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, that's pretty similar to how I feel about Randy Rosarena. He's always been a little bit of a streaky hitter. I will say there's the one concerning thing I guess I have with the Rosarena is, you know, Scott Chu, from the Hack and Jacks, he's on Hack and Jacks, yeah, podcast, and writes at Pitcher List, and I've you know, worked with him before. He's my editor at one point. Like, Scott got me really focused on rolling graphs and this idea of like looking at guys and saying, you know, if they're in a slump right now, does this just look like their other slumps, or does this look like something different? And a Rosarena, it's a little bit of both. And so if I look at a rolling WOBA chart for him, his rolling 15 game WOBA is lower, or it was, it still is. It's up a little bit in the last couple days, but even now it is lower than it's ever been in his career. So this isn't just like a Rosarena streaky, he does this, but it's the worst slump that he's ever been in terms of overall results. The second worst slump he's ever been in was last August. And so we're starting to see him like dip to new lows, which is a little concerning. When I go and look sort of under the hood at things like strikeout rate, walk rate, like, I don't really see what's changed and what's driving this. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just noise, and like, look, everybody has to have the worst slump of their career at some point. And so maybe that's what this is for Randy Rosarena. Like, maybe this is just, he was going to hit a low at some point. This is it. But I'm trying, like, I am digging in because I want to try to figure out if there's something more to this where something has meaningfully changed. But like, his expected WOBA has been worse than it is right now. His chase rate is actually sort of trending better in a lot of ways than it has for a lot of his career. His hard hit rate sort of looks like it's in his career norms. I'm having a hard time figuring out what's making this the worst stretch of his career. So I think at the end of the day, I'm coming back to the same spot you are on him, which is like, look, he's a slow starter. He's notoriously streaky. This is just the thing that's going to happen. You just got to roll with it. He'll come back. But I am having this sort of cognitive dissonance with a Rosarena where it's like, he's never looked this bad, and yet I can't figure out what it is that actually looks bad. It may just be that he's at a trough for everything at the same time. I don't know. But yeah, I'm not making any big moves with a Rosarena. Like, I'm at least going to give him through it. Given his track record and what I have paid for him where I have him, I'm probably giving him at least through May. But at the very minimum, I'm going a couple weeks into May and making sure that I'm not seeing, like, if a couple weeks into May he's still this bad and I'm starting to find some signs of what might be driving why he's been this bad, and there aren't like there isn't clear evidence of a turnaround, then yeah, I may be time to move on from Arozarena. But at the moment, nah, I'm happy to wait on him.
Which, just so folks feel better, like, if you have Randy Arozarena, like, we understand that sucks. Because, like, he's one of those players, you drafted him too high. Like, yes, like Nolan Jones, but we don't know that Nolan Jones is going to bounce back. Randy Arozarena, you probably are still thinking, like, yeah, there's probably still an 18, 20, 2020 bat in here, so I want to make sure I get him in my lineups. The tricky part is, when he's performing this poorly, you don't want to put him in. But when he does break out, if you start missing out on it, you're just never going to get the player that you tried to draft, at least in a rotisserie league. So it is really hard to roster him right now, but I would not give up hope on a player with his track record and just his ability to outperform his expected statistics still gives me hope.
So let's talk a little bit about Max Kepler, because Kepler is, let's put it this way. If you go to his Fangraphs page, and, you know, Fangraphs shows at the top of the page the articles the player was most recently tagged in. The most recently tagged article with Max Kepler is from March 21st. It's called "The Players I Roster Most in Auto New" by Chad Young. So I got Kepler on a lot of rosters. He started off horribly, but his season has been a tale of two seasons, as it were. The first five games of his season. Now, it's an early part of the season, so we're breaking a season into two parts. They're small. But first five games of a season, his triple slash was 050, 095, 050. He was 1-for-20 with a walk and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 strikeouts. Bad. It's not good. Then he went on the IL with a right knee contusion. And I've been trying to figure out, like, when that happened. Like, is it something that maybe happened earlier and he was trying to play through and didn't work or whatever? Because since he's come back, he came back on April 22nd. Now, it is still only another 21 plate appearances. Like, it's literally like I'm breaking a season in half here. But in those 21 plate appearances, his triple slash line is 421, 476, 684. He is... let's see, he's got 1-2 walks. He's like 8-for-19 with 2 doubles, a home run. He's got 2 walks and 2 strikeouts. Like, totally different guy. And I came into the season, like, Kepler's a guy who I've always been a fan of. It was one of these, like, I like the skill set. He doesn't strike out a ton. He gets a lot of walks and he has good power. And, like, that's the guy I want. That's always the guy I want. And he's never... like, he's always been okay, but then, like, he had that huge 2019 with the rabbit ball, and then it was like he went fell back apart, and I'd sort of, you know, given up on him. And then last year, he started striking out a little bit more, but hitting the ball harder, and it felt like, all right, he is recognizing, and I think it's a good thing for him to recognize, that, like, strikeouts aren't bad if they come at the expense of swinging hard and hitting the ball hard. Like, you can accept more strikeouts. And to be clear, his strikeout rate, like, Kepler's career strikeout rate is 18.4%. Last year was 21.6. So yes, he was getting more strikeouts, but it wasn't like he became a 30% strikeout guy. But in doing that, Kepler last year, I lost it now. His average exit velocity was 91.9. That was a career high. His hard hit rate was 47.6. That was a career high. His barrel rate was 12.2%. That was a career high. His xWOBA was 362. That was a career high. Like, he was a fundamentally better hitter last year than he had been before. We were seeing a legit breakout. And, you know, Kepler, it's funny because, like, I feel like I've been simultaneously, I'm like waiting for Kepler to break out and still feel like, oh, you know, he still has time to break out. Kepler's 31. So he broke, you know, that breakout happened in his age 30 season. That's not usually a great sign when it takes that long, but everything about what he did last year looks sustainable. And then he got off this horrific start this year, and now the last five games have been a lot better. I'm over invested in Kepler, but I think where I can get him cheap, I would still add him if he's available, because he did get dropped in some places. He's probably available for trade. I am debating in some leagues where I have him at too high a price in an auto new league and I need cash. Like if I find the ability to drop him for a cheaper outfielder, even one I don't like as much, I might do that because we know what the floor is with Kepler and it's not good. But I want to see more than what we've seen from him so far. For what it's worth, he tied his career high in max EV already this season. So while the exit velocity on average, the barrel rate, the hard hit rate have not yet risen to the level they did last year, he's only had 31 batted balls and he's hit a ball harder this year than he did at any point last year or any other year going back to 2016. So I am still very much in on Kepler. I think the changes he made last year are legit. I think you're going to see them shine through. And so my overall take here is despite the bad start, I think Kepler's a buy low, but I don't know. You're not as high on Kepler as me. So maybe you feel differently.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely not as high on Kepler as you are, but you know, the stuff that you pointed out there definitely piqued my interest. You know, I could totally see last year if maybe what actually was a breakout. Like we all know about the insane 2019 he had when he had 36 homers, 98 runs, 90 RBI. That was with a 122 WRC plus. That was a career high until last season, the 124 WRC plus. So I can totally buy that. And then, you know, you factor in, I was going to bring it up and you touched upon it at the end there. He's matched his max exit velocity this year. It seems like it's just his timing that's off right now, which is to be expected. It's the beginning of the season, even though he is a veteran player. I mean, his pop-up rate is really high. His launch angle is all out of whack. So I think it's really just a timing thing up to this point with Max Kepler. With that said, you know, it really would be a strange breakout for, you know, a guy who's pretty much been a career platoon player. And so I look at his projections from, you know, if you look at his ATC projections, 19 homers, three steals with a 244 average. To be honest, it's probably what I'm expecting. And if I get more than that, then I'm really happy with that. And maybe if it is a breakout, we can expect more in the batting average department. It's just we have a huge sample of not being able to expect much from him in that area. So I can buy the breakout. I'm just going to need to see a lot more because there's such a long track record of just kind of being a fine player.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's why I think when I mentioned, you know, a couple of places, like I have like a $12 Kepler in one auto new league, and like there may be a free agent outfielder that I can pick up for $3 and save a ton of cash that I'd be willing to make that change for. But otherwise, I'm still in on him. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to sort of flip this conversation a little bit. And Pete, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask for some advice. So be ready for that. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Pete Ball and Chad Young. We have been chatting about guys who are having some rough starts. We just talked about Max Kepler, and he is the inspiration for this question. But Pete, my CBS head-to-head league, I talk about this all the time on the show. I love this league. I'm off to a good start this year. I'm very happy with my team. My offense is a little weird. So I've effectively been streaming catchers, which is hard to do in this league because we have FAB twice a week, Sunday nights and Wednesday nights. And once you drop a guy, you can't pick them up again for 21 days. And so, you know, I streamed Elias Diaz when they were home for a full week, and now I can't have them again, even if they are home for a little while. But my offense in that league, I've got Ryan Jeffers is my current catcher. Matt Olson, who's been terrible, but I'm not super concerned about Matt Olson. Marcus Semien, who hasn't been what I expected, but I'm not super concerned about Marcus Semien. Rafael Devers, who has not been what I expected, but I'm not super worried about Rafael Devers. I can just keep saying that about guys. Francisco Lindor fits that category. Then I've got Andrés Giménez, who's been solid, not great, but he's doing fine for me as a middle infielder. Jose Ramirez, who has been Jose Ramirez. Then I get to mostly my outfield, and here is where things get a little weird. I'm using Spencer Steer in the outfield. He qualifies first, second, third in outfield in this league. It's a short bench, and so the ability to move him around is really valuable, but he's mostly been in the outfield for me because my other outfielders are Jung-Hoo Lee, who is starting to show some signs of turning things around, Jesse Winker, who I just picked up and maybe is just back to being Jesse Winker again. Who knows? Masataka Yoshida, who has both been bad and seems to be on the outs in Boston. He doesn't really have an everyday job. Will Benson, who he has 4 home runs and 5 stolen bases in the early going. His rates are terrible. So I'm not really sure what to do with that. Jorge Soler, who's been cold, but he's got 5 home runs. You know he'll eventually hit close to 40 because that's just what he does. And Vinny Pascantino is my util guy and another corner infield option. He started off really cold, but has been better lately, and I'm not doing anything with him. But that outfield of Lee, Steer, who's been great, Winker, who I just picked up, but it's Lee, Yoshida, Benson, Soler. None of those guys are doing what I would like them to do so far. I do have Christian Yelich on the IL. But then I go and I look at free agent outfielders. And let me throw some names at you. So Brandon Marsh is out there. Jock Peterson is out there. Max Kepler, like I said, inspiration for this, he's out there. Trevor Larnach, who's come up and is starting to hit, is out there. Alex Verdugo, who I have really never been a fan of, but he seems to be doing pretty well this year. Andy Paez from the Dodgers is up and performing. There are other names. Joe Adell. So given some of those names, I think it is time for me to move on from Masataka Yoshida. It might be time to move on from Will Benson as well. I don't think I'm ready to give up on Lee or Soler, at least for now. Who are you picking up from among those guys I just mentioned? I mean, you know, if I look at just purely the stats, Marsh and Verdugo have been sort of the best two. Maybe Jurickson and Profar belongs in that conversation as well so far. Adell, who knows what to make of him. You know how I feel about Kepler. We've already talked about him.
So is it non-base percentage league?
What do you lean towards? It's an OBP league. So the categories for offense are OBP, the 4 standard counting stats for 5x5, right? Home runs, runs, RBIs, stolen bases, and then extra base hits. But it's not extra base hits. It's doubles plus triples is the 6th category. So you have to specify that because you can have a week, and I've had this happen to me where I hit I hit 20 home runs, just have this insane week. And if just 4 of those had banged off the wall, I would have won extra base hits, but instead they don't count as doubles. So yeah, that happens sometimes. So yeah, doubles and triples is the other category.
Got it. So Andy Paez, who I really like, would be out for me. He is yet to take a walk in 42 plate appearances. So with it being on base percentage, I don't think I could make that move. I would totally see the value in switching out Kepler for Yoshida. Yoshida has been bad for a while now, and I think both of those players are kind of similar. Yoshida might actually have better on-base skills, but if he's not getting the playing time, then that's going to be a difficult situation. I think Kepler's also going to sit against most lefties, so I don't. And neither team though has great alternatives, so we might be seeing them more often than not. That's a toss up.
The reality is though, I would sit Kepler, I've been sitting Yoshida. I mean, Yoshida Cora is not giving me the choice. He's sitting him for me, but I'd be sitting either of those guys against lefties anyways.
Sure.
And so that piece doesn't super concern me because, you know, that's fine. Like, I'm just not, that's just sort of is what it is.
So then, I mean, you clearly favor Kepler over Yoshida. So I think that's definitely a move I would make. I would start considering Jurickson and Profar as well, especially over Will Benson. Profar has shown us in spurts that he's really good from time to time. And now is one of those times where he's really good. So you hope it's not too late. You hope you don't pick him up and then he goes back to being just Jurickson and Profar. But the dude is really hot right now. And I don't think you're going to look back and be like, there it was. There was my season. I dropped Will Benson and ended up with Jurickson and Profar. I just don't think Benson has that kind of pull. I don't think he's going to be somebody that gets scooped up in free agency. I think you're right to hold on to Jung-Hoo Lee and Jorge Soler, especially with it being OBP. Because even though both have kind of disappointed so far, they really haven't in OBP. They've been, if anything, above average. So I think you're right to hold on to those two. So it really just comes down to Yoshida and Kepler, unless I'm missing a name there. And I would add Kepler over Yoshida or Benson. I'd be fine making either of those moves.
So the other names, I mean, just to throw out, like Brandon Marsh, Joe Adell.
That's right. I forgot about Adell.
Brent Rooker.
Brent Rooker is a pass for me. Marsh, didn't he do the same thing last year where he started off the year really, really well and then just became unrosterable? The strikeout rate is still 32%. He's walking significantly less than he was last year. I just feel like the second you add him, it's all going to fall apart. Like, you see the six home runs and it's like, yeah, I want this player. He's not going to do that for you, though. He already did that. So Marsh is someone right. I'm kind of cooling on. Could it finally be coming together for Joe Adell? I don't know. It could be worth taking a look over Will Benson, because I just don't think you're losing anything by dropping that player. But the barrel rate up at 14.3% for Adell, and the biggest thing is the 21.6% strikeout rate. Looking at his stack, I had pretty much given up on this player, and looking at his Statcast page, I don't know. I might make that move. I might be dropping Benson for Joe Adell and dropping Yoshida for Max Kepler.
Yeah. So those are definitely things I am considering. Let's talk quickly. I want to talk about a few of the guys that we just went through, just to add a little bit of color to this conversation. So you talk about Brandon Marsh last year. Did he start off hot and then sort of fell apart? Yes and no. So if you look at his WOBA by month last year, 444 in March, April. Like, he was incredible in March and April. In May, he fell apart, 269. But then it was 321 in June, which is just fine. Not great, but just fine. 352 in July and 499 in August before it fell down to 318 in September. So he had great months in April and August. He had a very good month in July. He had basically an average month in June and September. And they had one bad month in May. That's not bad. And like, if you look at his first half, second half splits, it was a 342 WOBA in the first half and a 384 in the second. So, I don't know. Like, that's with, we talked about the Nolan Jones 400, 401 BABIP. Like, Marsh has been, let's see, last year his BABIP was 397. It is 367 so far last year. But if you break it up by half season, it was 398, then 396 last year. Like, it wasn't like he had some like crazy hot streak. Like, he has maintained high BABIPs. He's another guy who, like, his projections are all like 345 to 350 BABIP. So I agree. I think the home run power, like, I don't know. I mean, his hard hit rate is way up, his barrel rate's up, but I don't think he maintains this kind of home run power. But like, Marsh looks pretty good. I don't know. We'll see. He hasn't been walking as much this year, which really hurts the on-base percentage, especially given he strikes out so much. But it wasn't so much that he fell apart last year. He was hot and cold, but he really just had that one cold month. Otherwise, he was average to very, very good. So that's the story on Marsh.
He does kind of profile as somebody who could survive the strikeout rate, because the BABIP, he hits the ball all over the place. That's why the BABIP is so high. He really spreads the ball around. He's got fine speed, yeah, slightly above average speed. That kind of profiles as somebody who could post a high BABIP. I don't know, man. Maybe it's a gut thing. I'm just not into Brandon Marsh.
Yeah. No, it's totally fair. Jung-Hoo Lee, another guy you mentioned, talked about how you would hold him, even though he's been a little bit disappointing. I agree. So throughout, Jung-Hoo Lee, through his first 45 plate appearances this year, through April 7th, had a 59 WRC+. His BABIP was 194, but he was walking 8.9% of the time and striking out 8.9% of the time, which is exactly what you were expecting to see from Jung-Hoo Lee, right? It's like, good plate discipline, puts the ball in play, but, you know, low BABIP. He doesn't hit the ball super hard, so he's not, like, the home run per fly ball rate's not going to help him much. Since that date, he's had 68 plate appearances with a 131 WRC+, a 358 WOBA, 333 BABIP, 8.8% walk rate, 8.8% strikeout rate. Basically, that's what it comes down to with him, is like, he's going to be very BABIP dependent, because he's not going to hit a ton of home runs, and he's going to put the ball in play. He's going to walk enough that his OBP should stay high. And I don't think, like, the 333 BABIP he's put up so far in this hot stretch is really crazy out of line for him. And during that stretch, he has a 382 OBP. It's just a 410 slugging. Now, what's interesting about him for this league is, while he doesn't hit a lot of home runs, I do think he should have a decent number of extra base hits. And so he will help me in that doubles category. The sort of fun thing with him and Soler being teammates for my team and in real life is, like, when they have a good matchup, I can put them both in. But, like, late in a week, it's real easy to, like, on a Saturday when I'm like, man, I'm going to win home runs this week, but I need some extra base hits, to be like, bench Soler, start Lee. Like, go after it. Like, chase the doubles. Lee also, I was hoping he'd be a source of stolen bases, but he's got two steals and caught three times. That's a little, I'm not sure that's going to help. But yeah, so that was my thought on Lee. And then the one other guy I wanted to talk about quickly that you mentioned, you were concerned about the 0% walk rate for Andy Paez. He has always had good walk rates in the minors, almost always in double digits. In recent years, like double A last year, it was 17.6%. Triple A this year, 11%. Like, his history suggests he will walk. I think he's swinging more than he normally would right now because he's trying to prove he belongs, which is probably not helping him, but it's working. But the other thing to notice is he has a 76.2% first strike rate and a 52.1% zone rate. Now, for context, that 72.1% first strike rate puts him in the top five in major league hitters right now. So this is not among qualified hitters. He doesn't make it to this list, but there's only four guys with higher first strike rates than that: Brendan Rodgers, Byron Buxton, Sedano Rafaela, and Brian Rocchio. Other guys who are up that high are Nick Ahmed, and Adelis Garcia is up over 70%. Jared Triolo's up 70%, and Jackson Merrill. Now, some of that's weird. Like, I don't know why people are throwing Adelis Garcia that many first pitch strikes. I don't know why people are throwing Byron Buxton that many first pitch strikes. Buxton's can be a patient hitter, and so maybe that's what it is. But like, a lot of those guys are guys that pitchers are obviously just like, oh, Brian Rocchio, yeah, I'm going to throw you a strike. Oh, Brendan Rodgers, yeah, I'm going to throw you a strike. Rafael has been that, right? I don't think he maintains a 72% first strike rate. He will not be behind in counts at that same rate going forward. His zone rate, which is 52.1%, is almost 3% higher than any qualified hitter. There is no qualified hitter seeing more than 50% of pitches in the zone. So I think from that perspective, part of the reason, I think you're seeing a couple of things combine to drive down that walk rate to 0%. One is he's a rookie. He's called up. He has this shot. He doesn't know how long his shot is. He's trying to make an impression. He's probably pressing a little bit. Although the way he's hitting the ball, press away, Andy, press away. But the other thing is pitchers as of right now are just throwing him strikes. Like, he can't take walks. This is pretty simple math, I think, but if more than half the pitches you see are strikes, it's really hard to walk because it takes more balls than strikes to get a walk. Now, obviously you could have more than 50% of your pitches in the zone and have four of them in one at bat be balls. Like, that could happen, but he's not being really given opportunities to walk through all of 42 plate appearances. And given his track record, I think that as those numbers come down and he settles in, that walk rate's going to come back. And in the meantime, he's hitting the ball well. He's got three barrels already. It's a 10% barrel rate. His hard hit rate is up over 46%. He has a 364 xWOBA. Like, he's earning every bit of what he's doing. He's not hitting ground balls. He's getting the ball in the air. He's hitting a lot of line drives. Like, he's doing all the things you want to see a hitter do. And so I'm excited about it.
Yeah. I'm excited about Andy Paez too. I like him a lot. I hear you with the minor league walk numbers. I think the reason why he hasn't been given a lot of opportunities to walk, though, is because teams do not want to face the top of that Dodgers lineup. And Andy Paez has been consistently batting in the bottom third of the Dodgers lineup since getting called up. He did spend one game batting sixth between Teoscar and Chris Taylor, but otherwise he's been largely seventh or eighth. In one game, he was ninth. So I don't think any of the guys in the bottom third of the Dodgers lineup are going to see a whole lot of balls anyway. So it might just kind of be something that sticks unless he fights his way back up in the order. And one thing I'd say about Jung-Hoo Lee too, just for so folks keep this in mind, I think when guys come overseas as professionals, we just have this in our head of like, all right, this is the kind of player that they are. Jung-Hoo Lee's 25 years old. Like, could he develop into some power? I think he could. So I don't want to write him off as this like single digit homer guy or this guy that'll never give you power. He hasn't given us any reason to think we're going to get a lot of power yet, especially with the ground ball rate compared to the fly ball rate. But I would just caution folks, particularly in those long-term leagues, we're like, this isn't like Yoshida, who was almost 30 years old when he came over here. This dude is young. He's 25. So could he develop some pop? I'd be interested to see how that develops this year. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he was only a 7-homer guy this year, but I wouldn't be floored if he ends up cracking 15 and gets really hot in the summer. So I have a lot of hope for Jung-Hoo Lee. I think the skills are pretty good there.
Yeah, and Lee, for what it's worth, he's got a couple home runs already, which is not, you know, it's not like he's hitting 10 this early in the season, but he's got a couple, which puts him on a pace to be in double digits, which I'll take. I'll definitely take that. The other thing I'll mention with Lee real quick is I have often been an advocate for, waiting on these guys who come from overseas, that like, you don't want to be the first person to buy in because there's an adjustment period. He only cost me $2 at auction in this one, and so that's why I have him. Otherwise, and so the result is, I feel like you do have to be patient with him, right? I'm just saying, like, my feeling has always been with these guys, you've got to give them time because the adjustment is hard. It's a new culture. It's a new league. The ball is different. Like, all these things change. And so just be patient. Take your time. See what it looks like. Don't overreact now. All right. Well, I think that is about it. We're also having some weird technical difficulties here, but hopefully this worked. Thanks for sticking with us, and we'll be back with you next week.